I'm focusing on the role of a land claim organization, and meaning Makivik, NTI, and QIA, in the development of a northern social economy. Why I'm doing that, you could ask. But I'm a political scientist, and I've been working in the north for a long time now. I did my PhD about the Nunavut land claim, and and I'm teaching at Nunavut Sihuniksavut, so I get quite a few information, and I've told you also in here in Iqaluit a few times. So I've always been interested in trying to understand what is the role of those organizations that have been put together after the land claim. And because they kind of a very different object in governance, they're not government. And some of us said, mentioned they could be on the social economy side, but that could be argued. They have a part for sure. You know, one element of those organization is being part of a social economy, but they do much more than that. Makivik has First Air, and First Air is not social economy. Erinuit, maybe. And Charles Doric, we can argue later on that, but anyway. So all those are questions.
I don't answer questions.
You don't answer questions? No, I have no question about that. Anyway, Pita is going to be here tonight, so you can do it. That was my question. So trying to define that. And the way I've been working is through interviews, mostly, because I wanted to have a perspective of people from the north. Because social economy, Chris said, it's something new. Not the fact that some part of the economy is geared towards community well-being. That's been existing for a while, but that terminology. And, and it's interesting to do interviews in the north and talking about social economy and see what's happening and how people see it. So that's what I'm going to talk. And my interview were done, I've done myself some here in Iqaluit, but also mostly in Pangyirtung. And I had a student, an Inuit student, but did some in Puvi, Pouvonitouk, in northern Quebec, Nunavik. It's interesting, though, because I did mine in English, she did hers in Inuktitut. So we'll see. I'm trying to get a picture from all that. So that's my presentation today. Yeah, and the Makivik Corporation, QIA, and NTI are partners in that research. And why are we partner? Because what I'm trying to tell them is that, they are powerful actors in the economy of the North, and I think it'd be interesting to know more about, what they could do in the social economy, and to define that better. Okay, so next one. Okay, so defining the Northern social economy. So one down. First of all, I think it's very important. From the interview, it was very clear that you get two. First of all, I should say, now if you want to understand the economy of the North, I think the mixed economy concept is very important, like Frances has mentioned it. If you're only looking at the, the so-called modern economy or merchant economy, you're only seeing half of what's happening in the communities, especially if you go outside the big centers. So that center, and you have to, the way I try to conceptualize that is that it's distinguishing between a land-based economy, which is on the Inuit, based on the Inuit traditional economy. I mean based, because I don't think it's not only tradition, it's also what our people are doing in the community right now to sustain themselves. And then you have a state-based economy that came with the state, like Frances mentioned it. And that's linked to the involvement of the state in the north, and we know it's a strong involvement. So, in fact, and what I've seen in the interviews very also strongly is that social economy can be seen, there's a social economy in the state realm, volunteer organization, community group, non-governmental organization, non-profit groups, and charity. I don't mean they're part of the state, they are not the state, but they come with the state. They come to do things that the state doesn't do, for example, women's shelter, but they don't come from the Inuit economy. They come from the fact that the state has been taking more place in the north. And then the next one. And then the land-based social economy, which is based on Inuit tradition and values, and it's mostly around hunting, gathering, and sharing, and as mentioned. And in fact, in most of my interview, when I ask what is social economy, they always refer to the land-based social economy. Very, very few do refer to the volunteer organization, non-governmental group, non-profit group, charities. That doesn't come up. Even if, before we do the interview, I explain the definition of social economy. I say social economy is voluntary group, charities, and all that, but they all say, the first thing they say, first question is, what do you think is social economy in your community? They say, it's when I go hunting, and then when I share my food. So you can't dismiss that. I think it's, for many people, it's the, and in smaller community, the land-based social economy is more important. And I call it a social economy because it's hunting, it's gathering, but it's sharing. It's the culture as well. It's maintaining the link between people in a community. And this is also, it produces social value. And so, and also, fairly evidently, but in smaller community, most economic activity pertains also to the social economy, either state or land-based. That's another thing, you know, being in Pang, I went and I talked to all the, I went to the fish plant, I went to the Ukumutar Center, and to all what's happening there in terms of economy, but everything is linked to the social economy. The fish plant is for profit, but, you know, the main thing that people are trying to achieve here is to give employment and value to the community. They're not trying to make a profit. It's not the aim. So most of the economy in a small village is geared toward the social economy. How about Northern Co-ops? I'll try to answer that. That was an interesting thing because Northern Co-ops are some, are also, I'll say, yeah, we've seen very differently in Nunavik and Nunavut, and because they grew very differently. And that was also very interesting in the interview. So we're going to see what came from that. Okay, so next one. So I interview Inuit and the perception of the social economy. So there's a difference between Northern Center, where the state economy is prevalent, Iqaluit in many ways, and to a lesser extent, Kujawaq, and peripheral communities. Puvi, in short. And paying into more of a land-based economy is prevalent. So if we look at the role of the co-ops in Nunavik, in Puvi, and you have to know, Puvi is one of the birthplace of a co-op in Nunavik. So there's a very strong link between people in Puvi and the co-ops. So the first thing we find, you know, everybody mentioned that, you know, they really value the co-ops. And they value because it's Inuit owned, which is a strong thing, and they all say that it's our co-op. It's also linked to the Inuit values, and it was interesting. One of the respondents said it's linked to our values, but not our traditions. And it was interesting because it was making a difference between, you know, the core value of the Inuit and the activities. And also, they have mentioned very, you know, those elements of self-reliance. Effort and sharing, but came very strongly from the interviews in Puri about the co-ops, which was very interesting. So if we go to Pang, the next slide. Okay. Here, in most of our interview, the co-ops have been seen as part of a state economy and not seen as contributing to a land-based economy. And I have a quote from one of the interview. But I used to read, but it's really, and I was very surprised because I was kind of thinking that I would have, you know, I know that the co-op movement is not as strong in Nunavut, but I was thinking it was still, people feel they owned it, and it didn't come across as much. I'm talking for Pang here, I'm not talking for other communities, I haven't been everywhere. So they really don't see it as beside, but also you can understand, you know, for that person, when he thinks social economy, he thinks land-based economy, only that, nothing else. Okay, next one. Now, Inuit land claim organization. So I was trying to see now from those interviews the perception of those people about those organizations. First of all, I mentioned they have a very complex role. You know, they deal with the IIBAs, Inuit and Impact Benefit Agreements, which are very important for communities because it's a way you deal with resource company but come in the community to have benefits. So both are very key instruments. They deal with the compensation coming from IBAs or from the land claim. They have a mix of profit and social venture, and they do all that. It's very obvious from McKivick, less from NTI and QIA because they've been the younger corporation. McKivick is a very old thing, 75, 78, 75 McKivick, long time being. Also, they ring social program, which is another element that's important. You know, the hunter and support program. There's an elder program here in Nunavut as well, and also in Nunavik, I think. So, you know, both, it's like government there. And advocacy. So next. So first, the issue of the IABAs. We've seen that, and it's a tricky issue because I don't remember. I don't know if you remember, but a few months ago, that was when Liana Glugax was minister here in Nunavut. She asked at one point if she could sit with the Kitimat Inuit Association to discuss the IABAs that were negotiated at that time. And the answer she got from the KIA president was, Inuit Association, our Inuit Association doesn't deal with social issues. And so that said, you know, now it's a question, you know, and I think it's not prevalent. I mean, I haven't seen that answer everywhere, but it's also something that has to be questioned. You know, Inuit organizations, are they social organizations? Are they profit organizations? You know, what should they be? Anyway, so next one is issue of profit distribution. But that's another issue. We've seen in Nunavik, you know, for the Raglan mine, there's been a distribution of money to the directly to the community, big amounts in some communities. To say it is not a choice of McKivick that went through a referendum in the communities, but you know, you have to ask, you know, what is it a good solution to provide social value and capital to just give money to individual in a community? And we've seen it in Salwit, it's been a huge issue. Big paycheck given to people. First of all the money goes back to Montreal, doesn't save the community, goes for trucks and anything you can name it. So it's really a total leak of money from the community, plus social program that you add to that. Plus, you know, Raglan Mine has been trying to get an employment program for Inuit. They can't get it, you know, they keep it at 16%. Who wants to work in a mine if you can get money for free? So those are issues that needs to be seen, and I know that McKivick is aware of that, but those are issues that need to be dealt. And next one. And also very difficult to distinguish between profit-only venture and social economy venture from the Inuit organization. It's all mixed up. Air Inuit, it's profit. They provide medivac. They provide things, but it's not very clear what they are and where you put them. And the same for many venture from McKivick. And NTI is the same thing, yeah? No?
Well, I'm just going to comment on what you said about Air Inuit.
Yeah.
We have a lot of subsidiaries in which they take a lower profit and bring a lot back to the community.
That's right.
Of whether it be community infrastructures, flights to youth events, elders events, religious events. So what we're saying is we're taking a lower profit and they do bring back to the beneficiaries in some ways. Okay? Mm-hmm. And coming back to profit distribution of Wrangler, it's democratic. That's why they ask our own members how they would like to see the funds spent.
That's right.
Some people might disagree with it, or might have better ideas for the future. Mm-hmm. And of course, it's very, very specific to also landholding corporations in every village also, as well as McKivick. And that's why people from Salawit, let's say, in Kangdeng Sutuat, would get different amounts. Yeah. These were
community-based
agreements that were negotiated. That doesn't mean we don't want to change things and make it better in the future. This is look at different alternatives and scenarios.
Yeah, that's why we're talking about that anyway.
But it is true, you're right, that we do a lot of different things within one organization. Sometimes this is conflicting roles, okay? But that's the way it is.
Yeah, well, I'm not going to go into a conflicting role today anyway. Quite a bit to be said about it. Anyway, so. Next one. Our perception of land claim organization. I wanted to see, you know, the difference also between Nunavik and Nunavut. So In Pang, that was something came very strong. NTI and QIA are seen as part of a state realm. Not that they're state organization, but because they bring the same requirement as the state on the land-based economy. And because they're trying to reframe domestic activity in the state sphere, making them. So next one. And in PUV, Makivik is seen as part of Inuit realm, which was interesting. You know, they really say, you know, it's our, you know, that's our organization. But for many interviewees, Makivik is mostly seen as a cash flow organization, you know, not so much as a social economy organization. And for some, it has a negative impact on the co-ops, what was mentioned. But if you know the history of PUV and the dissident and all that, it's kind of normal to know that. There's always been a conflict between people of PUV and Kujuak and Makivik and co-ops. The last point I want to do, my conclusion, that was a very interesting quote from on policy and social economy that came from Pang as well, a quotation. So if you can put it on. And the next one too. Yeah. So it's a quote from Pang, and really what the essence of that quote is that, you know, all the programs that are here to support the land-based economy are seen to be non-effective because they call them business-like. It's not so much the business-like, in a way, the state-like. It means you need insurance, you need to fill out form, and all those elements. And what that interview is saying is basically, you know, if he wants a program to work for the people who go on the land, he has to find money somewhere else and do it another way because it doesn't work to get, you know, or to make them work like a little enterprise, you know, the hunters and the trappers in the community. So, and that was a strong message, and he told me that a few times, and he told me a few times nothing is going to change, and what you're doing here is worth nothing, and you know, so that's why I put his quote there, to say that at least I get his message out, because he asked me, oh, can I change that? It was a strong for him, you know, it was really a big problem. How can I help people to go out on the land, provide for the land-based economy without going through liabilities, insurance, and all that business? Maybe there's no way, but that's a question. Okay, so next, some preliminary conclusions. Okay. So Northern social economy has two distinct components, state realm versus Inuit realm, and I find in the interview it's very clear. If you talk to Inuit, they talk about land-based economy. They don't talk about charity and the rest of it. I've done some interview in Iran with people working for charities. Inuit, they still talk about the land-based economy. It always comes. Okay. Next. Nunavik co-ops seems to bridge the dichotomy. That was interesting. Nunavik co-ops are not seen as such a state-based. They're seen as owned by the Inuit and belonging to the Inuit, which doesn't happen as I haven't seen here in Nunavut as well. And that's an interesting thing. You know, can there's been an appropriation of that instrument, at least in Nunavik. And last one, I think. And also the other things what I have trouble in the rest of my research is to distinguish between profit only and socially minded venture through the land claim organization. And I think the North is all about that. It's very difficult to say, you know, this is social economy, this is profit economy, this is government. Everything is intermixed very much. So anyway, so that's it. Thank you.
One question for.
I think I know who gave me that quote from Pengnitu.
Yeah, I guess so.
And he has very valid opinion. He's somebody who would really like to take youth out to the traditional places that people lived around Cumberland Sound, and he would be an excellent person to do it. And I actually administer quite a bit of that youth funding. And when we get that youth funding, it's often from GM Clay, for instance, or GM Brighter Futures programs. which in their contribution agreement stipulate that the an outfitter who on a trip like that must have $2 million liability insurance. So it's right there from the government to the people, and you know, there's reasons for that, of course. But I think he does raise a good point. He's sort of trapped in the middle of the traditional versus the government regulation.
Yeah, no, thank you. No, I guess we know who it is. But I think he raise a good issue. You know, we're talking about public policy. And, you know, how can public policy enhance the land-based economy? And that's something that has to be discussed. Like Francis has mentioned it, you know, we're talking too much about mines. Mines are there. They're going to be provide money. We need to deal with that for sure. But we need to also deal with a more sustainable way of providing for the communities. And the land-based economy is still there. And it's still strong, like, nature has shown it in Nunatsiavut. We don't have any data for Nunavut or Nunavik on the strength of that land-based economy. But, you know, for most of what we see, we can, I would like to do some research on that anyway. And but, you know, it's still going on because it's still much cheaper to get a caribou than a steak from the northern or the Cop.
I don't know if this will help you, but in 1982, one of the best reports was done that I've ever seen in all my 40 years in Nunavut, and it was even aptly named. It was called Lords of the Arctic, Wards of the State.
I know.
By Colin Irwin.
Yeah.
And it's a beautiful example that all of the people in the north and communities said, right on, that is how it is, and that's where it's going if we don't do something about it. However, the government of the day came out and absolutely slammed Colin Irwin to remove him from the map. His study was flawed, he was no good, where did he get his data? And in a tremendous character assassination, pushed this study into oblivion. But everybody who lived up here agreed it was bang on. And there's a good example, I think, for researchers, where there wasn't the people around them to know how to use it, how to apply it, how to save it from somebody being able to just assassinate somebody's character. And we really grieved back then that this man was treated this way, because what he was saying, you know, was really like the canary in the mine for everything we're talking about today and the mess we're in. And so we've got to have a way to protect our researchers and respect our researchers, so they're not hanging out in a limb while we're silent. And the fact that you raised just last week, the premier went to our land claim and said, come on, we need you to get on the team. And they said, we're not spending our money. And it was all about the social, health, housing, education ills of Nunavut. And so I think you see there that great divide that's happened. They talk about not wanting to spend their money on people that are their own people.
Yeah, thank you. No, I know the Colin Irwin study. It's still on the internet. You can still find it. It's interesting because what he wrote in 1982 is still true. And now things haven't changed.